Well, you should have your Bibles open to Proverbs chapter 1, and we are just finishing off the last few little loose ends on perceiving the words of understanding, which rounds out the son's first initial attitude adjustment to receiving the education he's about to get. And I ended by just again noting and pointing up the fact that when we're looking at Romans 8, 14, and 15, you are given to know wisdom and instruction, you are made aware by the Father of the value, the importance, and the worth of what you are now going to get in this education. That comes by understanding that you've received the spirit of adoption, and what all that means, what stands behind that expression, is giving the Father, giving the Son to know wisdom and instruction. And it's not that it gets really detailed out or any explained at that point in huge detail, but you've got to pick up on this. Whenever you come across an issue that Paul gives, like adoption, and there's no explanation for it, he's going to do that again in the same chapter, in chapter 8 of Romans. He's going to talk about the creature. Doesn't explain it. He just talks about it as if you know what he's talking about. When you hit things like that and you throw a red flag and you say, wait a minute, I don't know what that is. That ought to tell you, there's something sitting in God's Word that I've missed, or that I haven't paid attention to, or I just simply haven't gone back and ever looked at, that he's expecting me to know what that means by the time he uses that expression. And this is one of those classic examples of that happening. And that's why we've gone through a huge amount of background work on this issue of adoption. The son at that point, recognizing and is made aware of the value of what it means to be adopted as an adult son and be offered the information and the education and the edification his father wants to give him, whereby it elicits this cry of Abba, Father, which is the normal reaction and response of a son in enthusiasm to his father and wanting to get the wisdom of his father's heart imparted to his heart. Then that alone is not going to really be enough. That's why this whole issue of what happens then in the remainder of Romans chapter 8, just knowing wisdom and instruction isn't good enough to establish the son. Or maybe I ought to put it this good enough. Maybe a better expression is it isn't sufficient. It's not sufficient enough to fully set the son's attitude and fully establish him in his sonship life, so that when the allurements of the evil man and the strange woman come along, the son won't go down that other path. He won't be foolish and despise wisdom and instruction and become a fool in his father's eyes. To do that, to get that accomplished, it's going to take more than just knowing wisdom and instruction. The father knows that there are now going to be competing allurements and competing attractions and distractions and enticements to the son that will seek to ruin the son's education even before it gets off the ground, so to speak. And by the way, if you think the adversary fights hard just to keep rightly dividing the word of truth a mystery, as we often use the expression, to keep the mystery a mystery in the minds of most Christian folks today, he doubles the effort to keep what you heard here in the last 5 minutes out of the minds and ears of most Christians today as well. And so the father knows that, and he knows the son's going to have every attempt to ruin his sonship life before it ever gets underway, before it even gets some momentum behind it, which is what that first exhortation in Proverbs 1 is all about. When you read there in verse 7, The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Verse 8, my son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. For they shall be ornaments of grace unto thy head, and chains about thy neck. That's Old Testament terminology for promotion within a business, or promotion within government. That's what this is going to be. That's that enticement for the son from the father. But there's the competing enticement. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not, verse 10 says. If they say, come with us, let us wait for blood. Let us lurk privately for the innocent without cause, and so forth and so on. He says, my son, in verse 15, walk not thou in thy way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path. There's this alternative that is always going to be held out. It's going to be looked at as the thing, the right thing, the popular thing. There's going to be pressure attached to it for you to continually be moved off course from your father and moved into this other competing wisdom and path. And so quickly, then following on the heels of that son's initial knowing the value and the importance of the father's wisdom and instruction, before the son can even hardly get a breath, the father then quickly is going to present the son with the grand scope of all that the father's business is going to be about. He's going to get that in front of that son's eyes, get his eye on the prize, get his eye on the goal, and he's going to quickly give him the grand scope of his business along with how the son's going to function in it, what your role is in it, what he's designed in it for you. It's kind of like the father takes the son and says, look, if you'll just allow me, then we're not even going to get underway yet. If you'll just allow me to take you under my wing, so to speak, then here's what's in it not only for me, but here's what's also in it for you. That's perceiving the words of understanding. So the father then gives the son information designed for him to perceive the words of understanding. And as great as that son's initial cry of Abba, Father, is, it's really, that's only the beginning. For instead of the novelty of the grandeur and the glory of the adoption of sons wearing off soon after it's received, which would be what would happen if all you had was to know wisdom and instruction, the novelty of it, the grandeur of it, could wane and could wear off. But instead of that happening, the son's attitude grows even greater by this additional perception of words of understanding. And so instead of the novelty and grandeur of the adoption of sons wearing off soon after it's received, God's made this so that that crying Abba, Father is actually intended to grow and to intensify. And that's exactly what the father wants to see happen and hear happen, coming out of his son's mouth as he goes on to establish his son and his sonship life by telling him all about his business right up front. Here's what my business is. And about the specific vocation that he has for his son and his son's going to have in the business. And especially when he tells the son about the vocational education and training that's been pre-planned, pre-written, and provided for him through the sonship curriculum. And all of this is what gets done when the son's given the second part of his initial establishment in his father's business, or the second part of his initial establishment as his father's son. That is, the son is going to be given to perceive the words of understanding, and the corresponding part of that curriculum, as we said and put on the board, it's written to us, for us, and about us. We won't find perception of the words of understanding in the book of Proverbs or in any part of God's program with Israel. We need to find that in the information that was written specifically to us that has our address on it. And that would be found in the letters of the Apostle Paul in the very next section of the book of Romans we're dealing with, in Romans 8, 16 through 39. And we've already taken a very tiny look, I think, at that passage. I've just sketched it out a little bit last lesson. But just enough to show you that you need to read this more on your own and notice the Father's doing exactly what we'd expect when He'd give us to perceive the words of understanding. We've noticed that, for instance, in fact, why don't you turn back there to Romans chapter 8 so you can get your eye on it instead of looking up here at something you can't see. And there in Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 19, he talks to us about that creature. We've already noticed that creature to some degree, and something of our vocation in it. And when I say the creature, should have this again is just this circle representing the entire universe. And that entire universe that God created when he created the heaven and the earth, he designed it so that the earth would be in the midst of that. And it's actually this whole heavenly places out here that he looks at in Romans 8 as the creature. That's the creature. That has a will to it. That has something that's an embodiment for the earth, and the earth was to be in the midst of that. And you and I are part of the body of Christ that's going to be placed in all of these various positions of responsibility and intelligentsia where we act as a body, and the earth with Jesus Christ in his first body seated on the throne of David, reigning there on the earth, and that earth is going to act as it were as an inner man, as a soul and spirit for all of this universe. That's out there today. And it's not going to be like you see it now. When you look through a telescope out there, you're seeing death. You're seeing the effects. You're seeing vanity and emptiness. But all of that is going to be brought back together in such a way so that this forms this magnificent body. And that's why you're called a new creature. That's why you're a member of the church, the body of Christ. And God has a purpose for everything that he created to function as a body, with an inner man and a soul and a spirit sending out information, to which there's members of us sitting right here today that's going to be part of this intelligentsia out here that have an intelligent understanding when they receive a signal from the earth, when they receive a signal from God himself of what he wants to do and how he wants to function, so that this all works in concert and in harmony and it functions as a body. And it's an entirely different perspective upon things than we've ever had before. And that gets put into your notice. That gets brought before your eye. The creature, something, we notice that creature and something of our vocation in it. And I say vocation, I use the word vocation. This is what you're doing now is training for a heavenly, eternal vocation. And I use the word vocation because that's the word God uses over in the book of Ephesians when he describes it. But that's also an excellent expression, because a vocation is a job or an occupation. Oftentimes you look at a vocation, especially by the white collar crowd, they look down on vocation, vocational training. But honestly, it's almost the opposite. The vocation is a job or occupation that is for one for which a person is particularly suited or particularly qualified. That's why this is called a vocation. There's going to be angels out here that are going to be messengers between us and God, and we are going to be able to put God's intelligence into effect to know what to do and how to do it and all of those kinds of things exactly as our Father would do. And we are going to be particularly qualified to do that because we've been trained for it now. And everything we're going to learn in the book of Romans, the Corinthian epistles, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, the 2 Thessalonian epistles, all of that information is information designed to equip you with the skills to make decisions. And we're going to practice on one another, and we're going to practice on our life at work and our life at home and our jobs and our family and everything else that's going to give us a context to put those decision-making skills into practice. Then that's all going to be translated into, at the judgment seat of Christ, being refined, and then us being able to be put in positions immediately to begin operating in the Father's business and be the movers and shakers in that business. And so that gets set before the Son right off the bat in perceiving the words of understanding. And perceiving that, noticing that with some real perception of what it means to you personally. And really, as we first looked at it, and I love the expression on some of your faces, the jaw-dropping aspects that are, and this is, by the way, that, if you think that's something, you ain't seen nothing yet. The jaw-dropping aspects that are given in that passage here in Romans 8, all that's designed to intensify and intensely and be an intensely powerful issue in the son's heart. And another crying Abba Father is to take place. And so it would seem that we're now ready as we... Let me get back out of here because, again, this isn't... Well, okay. I didn't hit my button right, but that's all right. When we... Where am I? This is what I want. All right. So we've got to know wisdom and instruction, perceive the words of understanding. So it would seem right now that we're ready to leave the first semester or phase one of our education behind us. If that's all properly working, and it's not because we haven't studied Romans 8. This is just the table of contents. This won't teach you the education. This just tells you what's in the education. But when we do go through that, it would be appropriate now to say, okay, we've seen knowing wisdom and instruction, we've seen perceived words of understanding. So it would seem to us, in looking at least at the table of contents here, we're ready to leave the first semester or phase one of the first level of sonship education behind and move on to our second semester. And the phase two of that, of level one, is to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity. All of verse 3 of Proverbs 1. However, there is a problem. It's not really a problem. It's another issue. It's an issue that's not in the table of contents. But it is in the exhortations. And in case you didn't see this, because our bulb didn't go out, but our bulb overheated when I was going to show you this again. And I went to all the trouble to make such a nice little presentation here. The book of Proverbs is actually broken down to where you have the table of contents given in verses 2 through 6 of chapter 1, and then from verse 7 of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 9, you have all of the exhortations that match each component in the table of contents. And I'll give you these before we go back to the book of Romans and pick up our study again in Romans 8. I'm going to just briefly give you my understanding of where these all correspond, and we won't go into it really. You're going to have to kind of take it, look at it, say, well, that's Mark's understanding, and check it out on your own. But I'm not going to teach the whole book of Proverbs. But once you see that the packet, it's kind of packaged together, the next package you get after the exhortations is the corresponding doctrine to everything that's in the table of contents. And that's from chapter 10 through chapter 29, and really you could say to the end of the book. But the final two chapters of the book of Proverbs contain prophecy, because this is information going to be picked up and utilized by the remnant of Israel. And when you get to Proverbs chapter 30, the very first verse of chapter 30, and the very first verse of chapter 31 tells you that those are prophecies. And so, really, that's my understanding kind of how the book of Proverbs is laid out. You'll have to settle a lot of this in your own time, but I'll give you some of these things. But what I'm after is that when it comes then to looking at the way that God has given Solomon through David to realize knowing wisdom and instruction, perceiving words of understanding, there is an issue sitting in the exhortations to that that has to be addressed before you go to your next semester. And I want to talk about that before we... And I intend to bring it to your attention now and probably go back and do a review of it when we get back to Romans and we get to the appropriate point where this kicks in. But I want you to be aware of it now, because these two things are hot on your mind or hot on your soul right now because we've just gone over them. So you need to be aware that the Father's going to set the Son down at this point before He begins this is where your education gets going in earnest. Before He begins giving you wisdom, He's going to say, in light of everything that we've just done in making you aware of the wisdom and instruction, and know its value, and that you've perceived and taken notice of my business and your role in it, and how that those words of understanding cause you to perceive that you have a personal usefulness to this information. I want to stop right there with your attitude now steeled to where it needs to be and in the proper position it needs to be. And I want to talk to you about something that is going to be critical from now on. And so I think it would be best for us at this point to, before moving on, recognize that there is a very important exhortation sitting here in the book of Proverbs designed to make the son aware what the father is going to do is. He's going to say, before we go on, I have some things to say to you that I'm going to check something just to make sure. I'm a big checker in my life. I'm almost, what do they call those people who, the compulsive, I have an obsessive compulsion about getting our thermostat set right before I leave. There's been times, I got to be honest with the poor deacons, the worst thing in the world would be a deacon under me, where I'll charge them to lock a door or something, and then I'll get a block away, and I'll sit there and I'll think, I hope they got this right. And you have no idea how many times I've driven back to this church just to check on something in the building and make sure, because it's not our building. And I've almost got this obsessive compulsive thing about me like that. But I'm a big checker. I want to double check, triple check. You know, right now I've got a war that I'm fighting at home between me and the squirrels. And the squirrels seem to be winning. Somehow, they got under my house. They were in my attic a few years ago. I fixed that problem. And now I'm totally obsessed with sealing my house off. And so I've spent time, I'm almost ready to get, the next step is to get concertina wire and some claymores and set them out there. And I have no idea I got them under my house. And one of them died. That's how I found that one. Yeah. There was a stink under there, and I had to crawl under there and drag him out. Then there was another little guy down there who was in there, and I shined the light on him. He just sat there looking at me. And so I opened my door to my crawl space door and sat there for about 15 minutes, and pretty soon I heard him, and out he went. So I've totally sealed off my house. I don't, you know, and I'm always checking these things, and I'm hypersensitive about some of this stuff. Well, my father wants to go through a checklist with me. And there's something he wants to check on in you to make sure that it's there and to make sure that it's at a level it needs to be, because so valuable is the wisdom and the instruction and the justice and all that you're going to get in this to this is more than any Harvard law degree could ever offer you. This is more than any Johns Hopkins medical degree could ever mean to you or be to you. This is not only so serious, but it's so fantastic and so not only worthwhile, but enormously valuable to you, that it warrants the Father stopping at this point. He's written an exhortation to you to check on something, and the something he's going to actually check on, he's going to check on your level of commitment to your sonship establishment. Now, this is something you may not like, but you're going to have to face it. This has to be done before you get to receiving the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity. And so the Father has designed and sitting in the book of Proverbs to make the son aware of the level of commitment he's going to have to make if he's going to succeed in completing his vocational training. Now, this exhortation is actually, come back to the book of Proverbs now, and this time come to chapter 2. Now, we've looked at some of this exhortation, but we haven't looked at it in the detail. I want to look at it now. Proverbs chapter 2, and I'm going to pick this up we could actually pick it up in verse 1, but I want to pick this up. Well, in fact, I think I will do that. Proverbs chapter 2, I want to begin in verse 1. This could actually go through the entire chapter, all 22 verses, but I'm going to stop at verse 9. He says, "My son," now this is a corresponding, like I said, how the book of Proverbs is laid out, this exhortation, and the reason I've told you before that why you get these exhortations is it primes you. It's just like spraying primer on a house or primer on your car. It doesn't look all that great. Well, exhortations sometimes aren't all that wonderful to go through, but it's critical because God created your human spirit. By the way, God created your human spirit to receive this education. It's already created that way. You know, they talk about these English waffles having nooks and crannies. Your soul, your human spirit has nooks and crannies. It has all the receivers all built there, ready and waiting to receive these words perfectly. That's what it's created for. But more than that, there is a before the doctrine gets applied, the exhortation primes you to receive it. So that when it does get applied, it sticks. It won't rub off. It stays. So this is a corresponding exhortation to the doctrine that's going to give that son the wisdom, the knowledge, the perception of the words of understanding. And actually, it's actually an exhortation prior to. I take that back. I misstated that. This is an exhortation prior to receiving the words of the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity. This occurs after the first two components of phase one are over. After you've received, you know, wisdom and instruction. After you've perceived the words of understanding, then this exhortation kicks in. Verse 1. "My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart unto understanding." You see how wisdom and understanding come up in this? "Yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her there is wisdom, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom, out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keepeth the paths of judgment and preserveth the way of his saints. Then shalt thou understand righteousness and judgment and equity, yea, every good path." Now, in just those 9 verses, you have wisdom and understanding coming up, and it's almost like it overlaps or dovetails into what it says in verse 9, judgment, righteousness, judgment, and equity. Those are terms familiar with what we're just about to get into. So this is that's why I say this hits right where you would be leaving the first phase of your first level and moving into the second. And it's a post-doctrinal exhortation for this and a pre-doctrinal exhortation for that. And it probes your heart to find out and make sure that your commitment level is where it's going to have to be. And this is where we're going to lose folks. And this is where we're going to lose a lot of saints, because you start talking about the level of commitment. And by the way, that's a subject that didn't come up very much in doctrinal circles, in the old doctrinal world that I used to be a part of. You never really talked about commitment to anything. I mean, it was always orders. You know, you're ordered there. Doesn't matter how you feel about it. You get your butt in class and you sit down, you learn, you take notes, rah, 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 you know, and gnaw you out about it. That's not how God does it. That's how an ex-military soldier did it. God does it in a way that exhorts you, that deals with you not as a general to a private, but as a father to an adult, fully grown son. And that's far different. So, He is going to probe your heart. But he's going to make sure that there is an understanding that there's a serious commitment you're going to have to make to this in ways you probably aren't thinking about. So, especially what I'm after in this exhortation is really found in the first five verses. Go back and look at that. My son, if thou will receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart unto understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. I want you to notice there are three if clauses there. If thou will receive my words in verse 1, so that you incline your ear unto wisdom and apply... By the way, it's interesting that when you discriminate words and synonyms, you have to, first of all, incline and then apply before study can ever take place. I think study is only used twice in the entire Bible. One of them is our very famous passage in 2 Timothy 2:15, study to show thyself approved unto God. When you really understand the word study, you have to, first of all, incline your ear and apply yourself, or real study won't ever take place. Study, by the way, is an advanced sonship term. But anyway, what I'm after is, you see there's an if, then in verse 3, yea, this is ramped up, if thou criest after knowledge. By the way, when you're crying after knowledge and lifting up your voice, what's happening? Who's talking? You are. Yeah. You're going to have to participate in this. I'm going to show you how Christ himself did this. The third one, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures. Silver, by the way, is being used there as an expression for money. And then you get to the then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord. That matches up to something you were told in the first exhortation back in verse 7 of chapter 1. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. That's not finding as if it's lost. That's like, I know it's all right here. It's not finding the book. It's finding it in the sense that it's owned by you now in your inner man. You now have processed it and it's become effectually working within you. So, this is kind of a, like I said, a probing of the son's heart. I want to show you that David's the one, by the way, giving this, David's speaking here to Solomon. In all the first 9 chapters of Proverbs, David is telling his son about how to be educated as his son. I want you to see that David was very familiar with this probing of his heart. Come over to the 139th Psalm. Hold your place here. We're going to come right back. I don't want to say a lot about this right now, but I do want to put it... In fact, it's not too many pages over, but I want to draw your attention to this magnificent Psalm of David, 139th Psalm. It's 24 verses. And I'm just going to take a little of this and give you just a flavor of it. You can read it all on your own. But look, pick it up at verse 1, and the superscription, of course, is the chief musician, a psalm of David. And some of these words are going to be very familiar to you. He says, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. By the way, well, let me read just a few verses. Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. And he goes on and talks about things here and talks about how God made him, and you get some of the very famous passages there about how he was made. But I want you to come down to the end of this psalm. Pick it up at... pick it up at verse... I keep moving myself. I'm going to wind up reading the whole psalm. But I love how he talks about the words that he says in verse 16, "Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect, and in the book all my members were written," which is continuance were in continuous or fashion, when as yet there was none of them. "How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God." See, there's a David is talking about, he's hearkening back to knowing his father's thinking, and he's expressing now how that, what that means to him all this far along in his life. "How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them." And again, he's looking at a general issue of knowing his wisdom and perceiving his words of understanding. "If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee." I like that. He goes to bed thinking about it. When he wakes up in the morning, "I'm still with you, Lord. I haven't lost my place overnight." And then he talks about this attitude of viewing this idea of a son to a father. It's like you know a son to his dad. As you're growing up, you have certain people you like and certain people you don't like. And most of that is based upon and triggered upon who your dad likes and who your dad doesn't like. "Well, I don't like that guy. Why?" "Well, because he's an enemy of my dad, and any enemy of my dad is an enemy of mine." Or, "I really like that guy." "Well, you don't even know that guy. I don't need to know him. My dad says he's a good guy, and any friend of my dad is a friend of mine." Well, that's largely what happened to David here with his father. Look at what he says. He says, "Surely that will slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord?" Pardon me. "Do I not hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred." By the way, you never hear that on a, you know, TV evangel. You never see that on a bumper sticker on your refrigerator door magnet. "I hate them with perfect hatred." It's in the Bible. "Why? I count them mine enemies." And it's because they're enemies of my father. Now, this is set within the context of the enemies of Israel. So he's not being just indiscriminately hateful here. But anyway, what I'm after is the last part of this, the last two verses. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts." That's what's going to happen frequently throughout this whole education, where you're going to come to a point where it's like a checkpoint. You need to stop for a moment, and you're going to go to your Father in intelligent prayer, and you're going to ask Him to search your heart. And there's going to be a probing and a searching. And David did this, was familiar. This was part of his life as a believer. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Now, before we leave this, I just want to bring something to your attention. Most people and Bible writers, when they handle the 139th Psalm, they talk about God's omniscience, omnipresence, and especially the fact of God's omniscience, that He's all-knowing. And that's what David is talking about. You're an all-knowing God. Because look how it started up. "Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou ways, you know my down-sitting, my uprising. You compassed me about. There's not a word in my tongue but what you know it altogether. You've beset me behind and before, and such knowledge," and so forth and so on. And that's all just passed off as David talking about God's omniscient. He just knows everything I'm going to say before I say it. Do you know how bad that is to somebody who's trying to pray to God? "Why should I pray to you? You know what I'm going to say before I say it." What's the point in this? "You know my thoughts." That's not what David is doing here. I'm totally convinced that's not a psalm extolling the omniscience of God. There's a word that belies that, that doesn't allow you to do that. This is a son in a two-way relationship with his father over a period of years where they have gotten to be so intimate and known each other so well, he can say these things. Watch, notice this. And I'm just going to throw this out and I'll get off of this, but notice, come down, verse 3. "Thou compassed my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. See the word acquainted? If you are omniscient, you know everything all at one time, do you get acquainted? No. You wouldn't be acquainted with anything. You'd know it all. I got all knowledge going forward, all knowledge going back, and side to side, up and down. I know everything all at one time. That's not terminology that's indicative of talking about omniscience. When you acquaint yourself with somebody, you don't know them until you go through a get-to-know period. And we say, after we've gotten through a little, maybe just minutes, maybe an hour, and when we leave, we shake hands and we say, it was nice to make your acquaintance. The word acquaintance that's used there tells me this is set within the framework of sonship, where God has taken the position of a father to David as his son, and as David is a man after God's own heart, and God's imparting his heart to his son, it's a true, real, viable, not an anthropomorphism, not language of accommodation, none of that business. It's a true, absolute two-way street. My father doesn't know what I'm going to say or what I'm going to think until I tell him. He's determined to act that way with me as his father, so that when I pray to him and when I talk to him, I know it's a true relationship. It's not creature to God, it's son to father. Now, could he? Sure he could. Is he omniscient? Absolutely he is. But he has chosen to operate and function with me as a father who doesn't know what I'm going to say or think until I tell him. And that's why this is all extolling David's personal two-way relationship with his father. And I'm convinced that's what that psalm is dealing with. It's not just some cold theological dissertation on the theology of the omniscience of God. But anyway, come back to Proverbs now. We're about out of time, so I'm going to wind this up. What I'm after is that what we're going to be looking at when we talk about the commitment levels, and there's going to be two major areas that we're going to be dealing with, that at this point, it's kind of a checkpoint where the son's going to have to face up to some things with a total, you're going to have to do this with a total degree of honesty of heart if he is ever going to go on and gain the full benefits of the education. And my understanding is what's contained here in Proverbs chapter 2 in the first five verses is what we're going to primarily focus on to check these sonship commitment levels. And at this point in your sonship establishment, you're going to have to deal with your commitment level to the education before you go on and get it. And I didn't write it this way. This is how God, your Heavenly Father, designed it. And this will all culminate in a point where you're going to reach a checkpoint and you're going to have to pass it honestly and you're going to have to pass it properly or else your entire sonship life will be in jeopardy. So I'd say this is a pretty vital issue because it could jeopardize somewhere down the line your sonship life. And in fact, the issues involved in God adopting you as his son and holding out to you a perfect education. Perfect. That's what you're supposed to be, right? Paul says, be perfect. A perfect man. He holds out a perfect education that will perfectly edify you and provide for godly edifying with all the eternal results of that. All of that is so deadly serious. In fact, let me show you again, and this would be a good place to kind of wind this up. Come over to 2 Timothy chapter 4 and get a look at a glimpse of what I talk about when I say that this perfectly provides for an education with all of its eternal results. 2 Timothy chapter 4. And this is Paul again. This is actually, my understanding, Paul's final letter, his last kind of will and testament to Timothy. This is where Paul will talk about being ready to go and fighting the good fight, all these kinds of things. But he's giving wise counsel to this pastor of how to deal with the adversary's onslaughts and attacks. And as he does so, come down here and pick it up in verse 6. He says, for I am now, Paul talking, for I am now ready to be offered. And by the way, that's not somebody who says, all right, I'm just too old, life's been too long and too hard, I just want to get on with it. That's the way most people die. You know, if they live to die natural causes. I'm just too old, I've lived too long. And by the way, that's how many people who are loved ones of elderly people look at it. Well, thank God they're dead. You know, because they've lived so long and life for them just held nothing out for them anymore, and they were in such a position, you know, that's not the attitude. When Paul says, I'm ready to be offered, he was healthy. He was awaiting capital punishment. And he's not saying that as one who thinks that life just doesn't hold anything else for me. He's saying that as a fully educated son, knowing exactly where he is, as a man of understanding in that final phase of his sonship life, where he recognizes my training is now over. It's time for me to start functioning in my father's business. It wasn't a despairing, that's not an expression from despair or from just not knowing anything else to say. I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. And that's how he looked at it. Sounds like he's going down to the train station, doesn't it? Sounds like he's going down to the depot and he's going to get on a train. The time of my departure, or a plane, maybe. Of course, if you're going to do that, you're never going to get off the ground. I'd take a train over a plane any day. And I don't like trains. But I despise planes. Not because I don't like flying. I like flying. But I absolutely despise the way any airline is run. But the verse 7, I have fought a good fight. If you want to talk about what the sonship life's about, in one word, it's a fight. And there's an adversary who's waiting for you. He hasn't even got his gloves on yet, but by this time, he's taping up his knuckles. He'll put the gloves on next phase. But he's waiting for you. For every one of you. And that's why you have to follow this path of this sonship life, because it'll let you fight the good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day, and so forth and so on. But what I want you to see is, I want you to see exactly what transpires here in the area where he talks about, I think I've got this wrong again, but I wanted to come back here anyway, but I wanted you to see where he talks about the issue of him, the exercise issue. Is that 1 Timothy? Maybe that's 1 Timothy chapter 4. Yeah, 1 Timothy chapter 4. But that was needful anyway to go over, because it does give you a glimpse into Paul's attitude toward things. But come over here to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and pick it up in verse 8. He says, for bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is, and this is what Paul was actually jumping off from, and that which is to come. What you're learning now has promise for this life now. The way you're going to make decisions and things, but also, it's not just that, but for the life which is to come. And so therefore, when he talks about those things, what I'm after is, that's what I'm talking about when I say that the son has held out to him this education that's going to perfectly educate and edify him and provide for his godly edifying with eternal results. All of that is to be looked upon, as Paul looked at it here, deadly serious. That such a serious undertaking as our sonship education demands that you and I have a level of commitment to it on our own part. And wherefore, in connection with our crying, Abba, Father, all the more the Father now tells his son about the kind of commitment he needs to make when it comes to him getting his vocational education and his vocational training. Well, I think it's probably a good place to maybe stop here for right now, but what we're going to begin looking at when we come back to Proverbs chapter 2, maybe you can start thinking about this on your own between now and Tuesday. When he talks about the ifs there, if you will receive my words and hide my commandments with me, so that thou incline thine ear to wisdom and apply thine heart unto understanding. And the second one, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding. And then that third one, if thou seekest silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures. My understanding is there are going to be two major areas in which your sonship commitment level is going to be probed and going to be checked. And the first one of those I'll give you right now is your commitment to learning. There's going to be, and that one there is the one that David is talking to his son Solomon about in that exhortation. In those first five verses of chapter 2 of Proverbs, he's talking about the commitment level that a son has to have to learning. And there's three areas that he has to have it in. And all three of those areas is one of those ifs. If, and if. And we're going to look at that commitment level and look underneath there. There's three different areas that have to come along. And then there's going to be a second area that we're going to look at. I might as well give that to you since you've been so patient. It's going to be a commitment to the effectual working of what you learn. And that one is the one that's the most important of all. And there's a section right underneath this, verse 5, actually from verse 9 and following, that's going to check you out there. And what I don't intend for you to do now, but what I'll intend for you to do when we get through Romans 8, is to come along, as it were, in each one of these. We'll come back and look at these again, maybe not in as much detail as we're going to look at them now, but we're going to remind ourselves, all right, when we finish Romans 8, and actually as we work our way through 9, 10, and 11, you're going to have to come along here, and you're going to have to remind yourself of these commitments. And you, not me, you're going to have to come along and put a check there and say, I've got that. That's perfect. There's no problem with that whatsoever. I've committed on every one of these levels. And then you'll be able to put a check right there and say, I've committed to its effectual working. And if you can honestly put a check in both those boxes, you know what you're ready for in Romans? Just curious if anybody knew what verse, chapter, and verse. Huh? That's right. That's exactly right. If you didn't hear her, she said Romans 12, 1 and 2. It's at this point you're ready to present yourself as a living sacrifice. And by gaining those skills of God's wisdom and justice and judgment and equity, you're going to be able to prove, you will prove, what is the good and perfect and acceptable will of God. See, that's a son functioning out, that's functioning in his vocation. You don't need to, somebody could come along and say, maybe I need to ask God what to do about this. And I'm not saying this presumptuously or arrogantly. You should be able to say, you don't need to ask God, ask me, I'll tell you. Because I'll tell you exactly what he's going to do. I'll tell you what his perfect, acceptable, and good will is. That's powerful. Yeah. So, anyway, that's. But I want to make sure that we realize what these commitment levels are and that you're aware of them. I'm not going to ask you to check them right now, but I want to make you aware of them. And then we'll go to the rest of the table of contents. So we'll stop right there.